2, Rogers versus Smith et al. You may proceed, Mr. Collins.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chadwick Collins and Sarah Fisher with the firm Milling Benson Woodward here on behalf of Sheriff St. Tammany Parish Sheriff Randy Smith and St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office employees Danny Culpepper and Keith Canizzaro. In this case, Your Honor, I would submit to Your Honors, I would submit to you that we have hopefully one of the more simple cases from a fact standpoint that you're having to deal with this week. The facts are really not in dispute, and I'll summarize them very briefly. In the summer of 2017, there was a woman by the name of Nanette Crintel who was killed in St. Tammany Parish. A homicide investigation ensued, and ultimately, there was no arrest made in that woman's death. In December of 2017, the plaintiff, appellee, Mr. Jerry Rogers, who was a former employee of the sheriff's office and who was at that time a investigator with the Department of Housing and Urban Development, created an anonymous email account and began sending emails to the victim's family members. In these emails, which are all on the record, you will see Mr. Rogers made a whole host of very bizarre statements, including conspiracy theories about individuals who may have been involved in the murder, whether or not the lead detective was a, quote, stone-cold rookie, whether he was clueless, these sort of things. All of these emails ultimately made their way back to the sheriff's office by way of another member of the family who sent them to the lead detective, Detective Daniel Buckner. Detective Buckner looks at them and is concerned that facts from his investigation are leaking out somehow, which can certainly compromise a homicide investigation. So they're very concerned. They open up an investigation as to these emails. Ultimately, the emails lead back to Jerry Rogers. In August of 2017, a few feet from where we're standing right now in the Hale Boggs building, two of our detectives went to visit Mr. Jerry Rogers in his place of work, the Hale Boggs, and started asking him questions. Now, they're not there to arrest, they're there to interview. Mr. Rogers, we have the information that you're sending these emails from a federal government IP address, mind you, and these emails are concerning an investigation of a homicide we're working in St. Tammany Parish. Mr. Rogers admits that he sent the emails. The interview continued for a few minutes. He ultimately terminates it and leaves. 2 days later, and ultimately was discharged.
Isn't that stuff, all the information that was under seal?
Some of it was.
You're just talking about it nonchalantly in open court. I guess I'm just noting that. But
I'm not getting into the details of it.
But I just note that that was in the orders of the court. But moving on, this is maybe a good stopping place. Why is this case not controlled by Garrison v. Louisiana, which involved the exact same criminal defamation statute at issue here, and the Supreme Court said the statute could not be used to punish criticism of a public official's public conduct, absent evidence of a false statement made with actual malice?
Okay. Great question. I created a little graph kind of distinguishes the cases that were discussed by the plaintiff and by the district court, and that's the first one on the list, Your Honor. That, and this graph is actually found in our reply brief, but I have an extra copy if anybody wants it, but it lists the five cases, and I think what the issue is, who is the defamed party? That's the issue. Who is the defamed party and who is a public official for purposes of the statute? In the Garrison case, who the defamed party was? A judge. An elected judge in the state of Louisiana. I think everyone in this courthouse, everyone across the entire legal profession in the law enforcement field would agree that public officials include elected officials. I think we can also agree that public officials include those who are appointed policymakers, like in cases of the the State versus Duffley case, also cited by the plaintiff, included a school superintendent who was appointed by an elected school board. In the case of Anderson versus Larpenteur, you have the sheriff's office, the president of the parish levy and conservation district. Again, appointed officials who carry policy-making roles.
Wouldn't a detective be a public official?
I don't think so, because the detective, in our view, is no different than any other hourly W-2 employee who is a simple government functionary. And if you look, and if you read in our brief, we point to some instances of this inconsistency as applied to cases like this. And why is that significant? Well, number one, it involved the same defendant, Keith Cannizzaro. In 2017 and in 2018, before Mr. Rogers was arrested, there were two cases coming out of our sheriff's office that involved the same district attorney's office. One was a case involving a Mr. Sewell, who was a former narcotics officer. There was an arrest made for criminal defamation in that case. And more importantly, there was also a case called involving two individuals. A lady named Amy Bido was arrested. Who did she defame in that case? An active duty colonel in the Louisiana Army National Guard. Who took those charges? The district attorney's office. And she pled guilty to that. The detective in both those cases, Keith Cannizzaro, okay? So in those cases, he's over there under the reasonable belief, in our view, that public officials in the criminal defamation context do not include those individuals who are simply getting a check as a result of their being employed by the government in some fashion.
Well, I understand that may be your view, but hasn't our court held in Gray versus Udovitz in 1981 that a police officer is a public official for purposes of the police public official rule? The court held that street-level policemen, as well as high-ranking officers, qualify as public officials under the test of Rosenblatt v. Bear at page 591. Did the court not hold that? Has that case been overruled? Do we not have the rule of orderliness here?
I don't believe, and I'll have to go back and look, Your Honor, because I've looked at a lot of cases in the last few days. I don't recall that case dealing with Louisiana's criminal defamation statute. Is that your understanding that it did?
No. We're talking about whether a police officer... We have a case dealing with the Louisiana defamation statute that we just talked about. And then you said, well, that doesn't apply here because a police officer is not a public official like a judge or a lieutenant colonel or these other people that you're talking about. But we have a case that says a police officer, a line cop on the beat, basically, is a public official for purposes of our rules. So if you put the two cases together, you would say that this argument is perhaps foreclosed that you were making. Perhaps not, and there's something that you want to bring to our attention.
I would suggest to you, Judge, that when you have a statute that's on the books in the state of Louisiana that no court has said is invalid across the board, the courts had only said it's invalid as to these class of individuals.
Public officials.
Public officials.
We have said that police officers are public officials.
But this court, with all due respect, Your Honor, never said public officials for the criminal defamation statute means everybody who gets a check from the government or everybody who happens to have a badge. Now, I get that there may be cases that talk about police officers being public officials in other contexts, but I think then you're making a leap that says just because in the context of, say, for example, I don't know, some union right or something regarding labor law, they're public officials, then you're supposed to take the next step and say, well, since they're public officials in the context of this statute or this question from a case from 1981, we're now to extrapolate their public officials with respect to a criminal defamation statute that has never been held to be applicable to police officers themselves.
It was actually a defamation law at issue in that case.
Criminal defamation, Your Honor?
It has to do with an officer accused of selling and using drugs.
Okay.
So that was the basis of the alleged defamation. I do not have the statute in front of me.
So if we, just for the sake of argument, say we disagree with you that police officers, detectives, you assert they're not public officials. Go along with me here. Assuming we disagree with you on that, okay. What is your next best argument?
My next best argument is the warrant, all right? Those two issues, qualified immunity and the warrant, both of which, if you find in our favor, I think forecloses this case and requires a dismissal of Mr. Rogers' cause of action. With respect to the qualified immunity, we think it should apply because of the arguments we just kind of went through, and I accept the court with respect to qualified immunity that reasonable minds may disagree. But with respect to the warrant, I don't see how we could ever disagree. Because in this case, our police officers went to the district court in St. Tammany Parish, presented a factually correct affidavit requesting the issuance of an arrest warrant. Under this court's prior holding in a case I actually was involved in, Davis versus Strain, the court said, evidence to support the conviction is not required. Subjective intent, motive, or even outright animus are irrelevant, and a court confines its inquiry to the objective assessment of whether a reasonable officer could have believed the arrested issue to be lawful. So again, what can a reasonable officer believe that this arrest was lawful? Especially when all the facts presented to the district court were laid out, the district court, who was supposed to be the expert on the law, looked at it, presumably looked at the law, that's his job, and made a determination that, again, he may have just disagreed or didn't know about this case from 1981, but nevertheless, he said, I think there is probable cause, and therefore a warrant was issued.
Didn't the lawyer in the district attorney's office tell you that the defamation charge might be unconstitutional?
There was a discussion where there was a verbal concern raised, all right, about whether or not the statute was constitutional or not. They gave us nothing in writing. They gave us nothing definitive. They expressed an opinion. Ultimately, several days passed by, and the decision was made, you know what? They got an opinion. We've got an opinion. Let's go to the person whose opinion matters. Let's just give it to the district court.
But you didn't give it to the district court. You didn't say the DA thinks this, we think that. You're the judge. You didn't tell the judge that there was any kind of issue regarding the First Amendment and that you had heard from the DA.
Well,
and I don't mean you personally. When I asked the question, I wasn't talking about
you. In our view, Judge, that's not really what we're supposed to be doing at that stage.
Yes, sir. You're supposed to give all the relevant information to the judge.
About the crime, not about people's opinion about a statute. The legal opinions are for the court, not for the law, certainly not for
the judge. You don't think the judge would want to know that the DA specifically advised that this arrest would be unconstitutional?
He didn't specifically advise. I mean, we got to be careful.
Generally advised?
Say again?
Generally advised?
He didn't even do that. Our testimony from the record is that there was a concern expressed about a possible constitutional issue with respect to this statute as applied to this defamed individual.
Do you not think the judge would want to hear at least that?
You asking me to get inside the judge's head? I don't know.
Well, the judge, you don't have to get inside the judge's head because the record actually indicates the judge was hopping mad that he wasn't made aware of this information.
Is there a statement that from he the was, judge, Your Honor, that I'm
yes, the, in the record, there's the interview with the FBI that says you can't believe they didn't tell him about this. So, I mean, I don't know if hopping mad was probably not a characterization, but he didn't seem pleased, perhaps, in that. But it wasn't just one time that the DA said that this was probably or might be unconstitutional. It was two times, wasn't it? Didn't Culpepper call back on the phone and or officer or deputy, whatever the correct title of him, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to be disrespectful. And did he say to the DA's office and said, look, we're going forward. What do you have an opinion on this? And the said probably unconstitutional. So it was the meeting and then a follow-up conversation also.
The same day the warrant was submitted to the court. I'm not
right.
Sure if it was immediately before or immediately
but
after.
That's two different times that the DA's office, like the first time they said, we need to go study this a little bit, but we think it's unconstitutional. And the police department decided not to wait for the study But they called back, said, hey, we're going forward. Do you think this is a problem? And they said, yes, we think it's probably unconstitutional. So it was two times the DA's office warned. Is that not factually accurate?
That it is accurate to the point that there were two separate conversations. I don't recall if the second conversation took place after the warrant had already been submitted. I think it had. I think they'd already submitted the warrant, and the conversation occurred. At that point, the sheriff's office took positions out of our hands. We'd submitted to the judge. We've done our job. We've given.
Well, it's not out of your hands, because if you knowingly serve a warrant that you believe is it could be unconstitutional, even if it's been blessed by a magistrate or a district judge in this case, that can still put you on the hook. You're not immunized just by the nature of the warrant if it's obviously without probable cause. There is both the petitioning for the warrant side of the house, whether that's constitutional behavior, and it's the execution. And I think that one of these officers personally who did the affidavit also personally executed the warrant. Isn't that correct?
I think Keith Cannizzaro, he was the one that submitted the
affidavit
for the
yes.
arrest of Mr. Rock.
And he was the one who went to arrest.
I believe so.
Yes, so he was on both sides of it.
Well, back to the fact is, again, the job, as outlined by this court's prior jurisprudence, is for an officer to give factually correct information to a magistrate. It is not the job. And if the court wants to make that rule, let's make the rule that says, if you get opinions from other folks, throw that in your affidavits too. But that's not the rule as it presently states. The rule for officers in going to magistrates for warrants is give them correct information to the best of your belief.
Okay, I think you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Question. Did this office, this district attorney's office, solve the initial murder?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Solve the murder that all this was about?
No. The entire case file has been turned over to the district attorney's office, I think, about 2 years ago, and there has been no warrant, no grand jury indictment, no arrest. Nothing has been done since.
That's relatively incompetent, wouldn't you say?
I'm sorry?
Relatively incompetent.
Of the DA?
If nothing's happened.
Well, the problem is you got to have a suspect that you can convict, and that's the issue here. This woman died alone in a house.
This was all the criticism of the office that started the action against Mr. Rogers. So I'm just curious if he was right.
Well, I guess time will tell ultimately, but as it stands now, there has been no one, and there have been dozens of agencies have looked at this, including the FBI, the ATF, a whole lot of folks with very wide expertise have looked at this death, and no one has said, that's the guy you need to go arrest.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. You saved time for rebuttal. We'll hear from Mr. Most.
Thank you.
Or is it Most?
Most, Your Honor.
But no offense taken. Mr. Most.
Thank you. William Most, good morning, Your Honors. William Most and my colleague Hope Phelps on behalf of Plaintiff Jerry Rogers. I'll note a couple things briefly, Your Honors. Number one, Your Honor was correct that Gray v. Yudovitz involved the specific application of the public official question under the New York Times v. Sullivan standard, which of course is what the absence of that standard is what the U.S. Supreme Court found to be fatally defective to Louisiana's criminal defamation law.
What do you do with the argument that says we don't have a duty to tell the judge that people think this is unconstitutional?
Mr. Collins is incorrect that their only job is to give accurate facts. It is also an obligation not to make material omissions from an arrest affidavit.
Is it an omission that the statute's unconstitutional?
I'm not sure the case law is extremely clear on that, Your Honor. I mean, it is certainly a fact that the sheriff's office went to the DA's office and was told the potential unconstitutionality of this arrest, the feeling that a police officer is a public official. That's our page 1186 of the record. Mr. Sims referred to the law as being unconstitutional several times, 1191. So it's a fact that the sheriff's office was told that. I don't think this court has ever specifically said whether that has to be included in an arrest affidavit.
But nonetheless, is your position that they would the officers knew at that point. So regardless of whether the warrant is issued, they know that there's not probable cause because of the serious doubts of the constitutionality.
That's right. They subjectively knew that. And also, I think it's important to recall that plaintiff moved for summary judgment on two claims, false arrest under the Fourth Amendment and false imprisonment under state law, both of which are claims that do not incorporate a subjective component. So those are judged only from an objective perspective. Would a reasonable officer have sought this arrest warrant, regardless of what was subjectively in these officers' head?
So whether or not they told the judge, would they have sought the warrant knowing what they knew?
Exactly, and frankly, Your Honor, whether or not the DA told them anything at all. I mean, even in the absence of this advice from the DA's office, there would still be a Fourth Amendment claim because no reasonable officer should seek an arrest warrant for conduct that is not illegal under state law. That's the holding of Garrison and the cases that followed it, is that criticizing a public official in Louisiana is not a crime, because the only statute to that was declared unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1964.
What do you say to the argument that, well, they have their own view about whether that's unconstitutional or not, and it's not informed by what the Supreme Court said in 1964 or what we said in 1981 or what the DA said a couple times more recently? They have their own view, and why isn't that protect them as objectively reasonable officers?
Sure, because, Your Honor, the Fourth Amendment claim for false arrest is judged under an objective standard. So regardless of what was going on in their head, if they were genuinely confused or nakedly retaliatory, what was going on in the officer's head does not matter for plaintiff's Fourth Amendment claim, which is what the trial court granted summary judgment on to plaintiff. Now, it might be relevant for the First Amendment retaliation claim, right? And so that is why plaintiffs didn't move for summary judgment on First Amendment retaliation, because it does require that getting into the officer's head, which is a difficult thing to evaluate at the summary judgment stage, we thought would be better for trial.
What do you ask for us to do today?
To affirm the trial court's ruling in every way.
With respect to the defamation claim, does it matter that the comments were in a private text and not public?
It does not, Your Honor. The federal case law does not limit the unconstitutionality of the statute to public versus private expression. I would also point the court to Bickle v. Burkhart, which is a Fifth Circuit case from 1980. That's 632 F. 2nd, 1251, which notes that private as well as public expression is protected by the First Amendment.
Wouldn't private be more protected?
I would think so, Your Honor. Yeah, that's my reading of the case law. I mean, these were private emails, and the fact that they were anonymous is also protected by the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And I think there's a whole series of case laws holding that sheriff's deputies are public officials. I think the clearest statement of that is in Thompson v. St. Amant, which is a Louisiana Supreme Court case that said, we must decide whether Thompson, a deputy sheriff, is a public official within the meaning of the rule announced in the New York Times case. We hold that he is. I mean, that is, I think, unusually clear. And this court has also held similar things more recently than Gray v. Yudovitz in Collins v. Ainsworth, Villarreal v. City of Laredo. This court has repeatedly referred to not just the person at the top, but the officers on the street as public officials because they are the ones out there with the discretion to enforce laws. And in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court in New York Times v. Sullivan based the whole public official distinction in part because public officials get protections, special protections that private individuals don't. And so it's only fair that they can be criticized for their conduct. And I think that's a distinction that my colleague has never explained, why these sheriff's deputies would be public officials for the purpose of qualified immunity. Because they repeatedly say they're public officials, they're entitled to qualified immunity. That's the only reason why they have interlocutory jurisdiction to be here. And yet at the same time are not public officials for First Amendment analysis.
Do we have jurisdiction over the motion to strike appeal?
It seems
to be before us.
Yeah. I mean, the motion to strike you can hear, but it's our contention that you don't have jurisdiction over the discovery order that there was appealed. It was...
Do we have jurisdiction over that? And why not? Why don't we?
For three reasons, Your Honor. First, because there's no independent interlocutory jurisdiction for a discovery order. The only plausible thing there could be is pendant appellate jurisdiction, and defendants in their opposition to our motion to strike specifically said there is no pendant appellate jurisdiction.
Is that moot or is that still ongoing?
I'm sorry, is what...
Motion to strike. Do we need to rule on that?
Your Honor, the court carried it with this case, so I think it has not been
ruled on. But it's not, it still needs to be, it's still a dispute between the parties and...
Yes, Your Honor. The trial court issued the protective order, that was appealed, and there's no independent interlocutory jurisdiction. Also, it wasn't mentioned in the notice of appeal, and it was ruled on approximately 6 months before the notice of appeal, so it's also not timely. I think it's clear that the appeal of that discovery order should be struck.
What is there summary judgment? I thought there was summary judgment evidence about police training. Can you?
There was some discussion in deposition of training. For example, the sheriff was asked if your officers were specifically advised that there was a potential constitutional problem with a particular arrest, is that something they should tell the judge when seeking a warrant? And the sheriff said yes. So, and I believe he said that was consistent with his training, although I'd have to go back and check.
Okay, so we don't have any training evidence about whether or not you should execute a warrant under certain circumstances, or more generally about the legal issues that the officers confronted.
I don't believe there's a lot of evidence in the record about training, particularly because we're not making a Monell claim based on training. The sheriff was personally involved here. He was the one who approved the moving forward with the warrant, so we haven't... plaintiff's theory is not a failure, inadequate training claim.
It's, right, but I just was wondering if they had been trained so that they were reasonable officers who would so miss this.
Your Honor, I don't specifically recall, although I'll note for the Fourth Amendment claim, the actual training they got is not relevant because it's an objective standard, and any officer should be expected to know about a consistent line of case law from 1964. I mean, we're looking at close to 60 years of consistent case law that it is unconstitutional to arrest someone for defaming a public official, and a sheriff's deputy is a public official. And I'll say one thing that has particularly bothered me about this case is that each of the defendants was asked at deposition, knowing everything you know today, would you still do it again? Would you still arrest Jerry Rogers? So even having heard from the DA's office in the first meeting that it was potentially unconstitutional, in the call between Culpepper and Sims, where Colin Sims told you that he thought it would be unconstitutional to arrest Jerry Rogers, that's very explicit. Then Judge Gardner, after the arrest, finding no probable cause. The DA's office not pursuing it, and then the Attorney General's office declining prosecution and issuing a written statement that it would be unconstitutional to proceed with prosecution. Knowing all that, would the defendants still today seek the arrest of Jerry Rogers? And each one of them said yes. Are there any further questions?
I think we have your argument.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Looks like I'll, all right, thank you. Just to go back on a couple of points, Judge. I think first it bears pointing out that if we're looking at what reasonable officers should and shouldn't do, let's step back and look at what they actually did, which is they tried to do the right thing here. They tried to go interface with the district attorney's office, who ultimately had a conflict of interest because Mr. Rogers' wife worked for them. We found that out later. All right, so it begs the question, why did they even meet with us to begin with? That's a question for another day. But nevertheless, we tried to do the right thing. That's sort of that objective reasonableness that we talk about in the law. Well, when these officers were under no duty to meet with the DA's office at all they had to do was collect facts, go to the district court, say, here's some facts, Judge, can we arrest this individual or not? That's all they were obliged to do. They went a step further. They met with the DA's office. They tried to get more input. ultimately the input they got was less than clear, right? So they said, well, you know what? We know how to do it the right way, which is go to the judge, let him make the determination. We can argue all day about whether the judge should have been told about a conversation where somebody had an opinion. I don't think that's the law. And again, going back to qualified immunity, unless it's been clearly established that's the law, then they had no duty. Judge Willett, I want to get to something. I read with great interest your dissent in the Cole versus Carson case from a few years ago. I share your frustration with qualified immunity. It is an imperfect solution to an intractable problem of how do we balance the rights of individuals with the ability of law enforcement, government officials, to do their job without being second-guessed in the court system. I don't know that there's ever going to be a way to do this perfectly, but what we have here is qualified immunity. That's the rule laid down to us by the Supreme Court, in which they say what's clearly established, got to mean something more than, hey, go extrapolate from this case where we talk about people being public officials in one context, and then bring it forward into a different context under a criminal defamation statute, apply it. We're asking law enforcement to become constitutional scholars in that case. Let's also remember, the Louisiana legislature, in its infinite wisdom, repealed the criminal defamation statute in 2021. This is probably the last opportunity this court is going to have, hopefully, to opine on all of this. So we can make a ruling and say, hey, look, qualified immunity under the Kokesh, this court's decision, applies when an officer makes a decision, even if constitutionally deficient, but nevertheless reasonably misapprehends the law. That's what happened here. At best, we made a decision which may be constitutionally deficient.
That's a much closer case than this one, and it seems that your argument proceeds under the idea that if the warrant exists, that everything is insulated. But, you know, under Melton and Malley and many other cases, the presence of a warrant doesn't immunize or provide qualified immunity, even where the officers should not have executed the warrant, even if a warrant is obtained. Especially if they know the circumstances under which the warrant is obtained. The warrant doesn't say they can do. You can't do anything with the warrant if you know that there's a problem. And that we have many cases on that. So can you address that?
I can, and I would point the court back to the Davis case, which cites the earlier Fifth Circuit case of Smith versus Gonzalez for this very important proposition, which is. Only an affidavit for a warrant that contains an inaccurate statement which materially affects the showing of probable cause renders a warrant invalid. Show me where anything in that affidavit was materially inaccurate. Nothing has ever been alleged to be inaccurate. The only thing alleged is you should have told us about the conversation you had with the DA's office where he gave you an opinion.
It's not about that there is a very real doubt as to whether or not, because in light of the 1964 opinion and the 1981 opinion, all of these opinions.
I guess we disagree and you get the last word. I'm just the stupid lawyer, but I will tell you.
No, sir, no one is calling you stupid here today. I'm just asking you, do you believe that a warrant immunizes a lawyer, an officer's conduct such that as long as there's not a factual error in the warrant, the officer can go to town with a warrant, even if there's reasons to believe it's invalid?
If we trust what this court said in Davis, absolutely. Because this court said subjective intent, motive, or even outright animus are irrelevant. So yeah, if that Davis means what it means, then yeah, the officer's only obligation is to present the neutral magistrate accurate information in an affidavit. Beyond that, they have no further obligation. And if we're gonna make a new rule, let's make a new rule.
It's not a new rule.
Well, then it would be contrary to what the court said in Davis, I guess, is my point.
Thank you, sir. We have your argument.
Thank you.
I believe this concludes our arguments for today. And we